Hi Mel, can you hear me? How are you?
Yeah, struggling on.
Yeah, tell me about
Being
it.
able, well, callus is getting a bit more confident, so I'm able to get out and about.
Oh,
So it's
that's
been good.
really good news. And you're feeling better as well, yeah?
Yeah.
No
That
doubt
was
it goes
just
with
a
the territory
24-hour
of
thing a couple of weeks
de-stress.
ago.
Yeah,
Yeah,
marvelous.
it is a bit stressful whenever major stuff happens, but that's life.
Yeah, indeed. Well, you guys have coped with it superbly. So Sunak's called the election on the 4th of July. I suppose not a huge surprise, but mixed reaction in the press. I mean, wondering whether the timing isn't designed to diminish the vote because people will be sort of on holiday or otherwise demotivated. What do you think of the tactics? Do you think the timing's right?
I don't. I mean, I was surprised at the timing because it seemed to me he's sort of going while before any of the recent proposals and the benefits that we have, which is the case, that real wages are now increasing at a faster rate, increasing. In other words, the rate of wage increases is outstripping inflation, which has come down to very close to the long-term 2% target. But whether people are going to feel that within the next 6 weeks in their pockets, I don't know. And maybe the government has, or the Prime Minister has decided just that, they're never going to give the Conservatives credit for this. So to move on. And there's all these sort of background rumours, which I never know whether to make anything of them, claiming that there was a leadership challenge or a vote of no confidence planned in the Prime Minister. And he was calling the election to preempt that. I don't know if there's anything in that at all, but it is a rumor that's been going around. But I mean, July's not a bad time to have an election, as you mentioned, from the point of view of the government. The students tend not to be in session by then. The university terms tend to have finished, so the difficult university seats for the government, where they lost seats, may not be quite so bad. Whether the students, will vote in their home territories or not, we don't know. But notoriously, the 18 to 25 age range is not very good at voting, or chooses not to vote, or however he wants to put it. I mean, all the conventional wisdom for a long time now has been the Conservatives are toast whenever they go. But presumably, somewhere in the background, there's been a thought that this might not be as bad as leaving it till the last minute.
According to Article and Prospect this month, it's Labour's election to lose, in that there are various fault lines that roughly seem to equate with the perhaps pragmatic rejiggings of the goals, targets, pledges. This is always suspicious about furniture polish involved in these proceedings, but style is issued from time to time. Do you feel he can get his act together within 6 weeks? Has the preparation been stealthy enough and consistent enough?
Well, we've been saying for a long time that my view for a long time has been that Starmer was the Michael Howard figure or the Neil Kinnock figure who would reform the Labour Party, rid it of most of its anti-Semitism, which he's done very well. There's still pockets, unfortunately, around as we've seen recently, but generally speaking, Labour is returning to being an honourable, non-racist party and moving away from the Corbyn years in that sense. But whether he's got the either the vision within himself or the ability to inspire that vision in other people, I'm very sceptical about. And I think there is some truth in the argument saying that whereas in 97, I think was a real pro-Blair vote in that, even though the main thing that was going on was people being pig sick of the Tories after 18 years and the Black Wednesday, the ignominious exit of the UK out of the European exchange rate mechanism was quite fresh in the mind there. But there was also a considerable amount of excitement at the charisma of Tony Blair. I'm not sure that, and that was reflected in the fact that he went on to win one more landslide and even in 2005, a quite comfortable election victory, albeit on only 36% of the vote. I'm not sure that there is that same sense about Starmer being the thing that's going to only get better type figure, and of course he's not going to have much wriggle room because of the state of the economy. So I don't know. I can imagine the new Labour administration getting into a lot of difficulty really quite early on, and that'll then be the test as to whether Starmer's got what it takes.
What is the precedent for sort of feel good amidst austerity? I suppose wartime is the classic case, but it would be sort of distasteful and ignominious to try and evoke Churchill in these times, trying as they are. I mean, what sort of cultural resources can someone draw on in order to, as Starmer, you argue, has done in terms of reforming the party, to unite the country?
Well, the usual nature of the cycle of these things is that the party which finds itself in that position of having to govern through austerity is usually the Conservatives, because usually they're coming into power, at least in part, because Labour has let the economy go, and there's a recognition that there needs to be a period of great sobriety around public expenditure and the like. And the Tories, which traditionally have played that role and played it rather well, of course, they both have not played that role very well in recent years. If they do leave office, they'll be leaving a massive debt and a massive deficit, which is not the usual position that Conservatives leave office with. So from that point of view, the example, I mean, Thatcher clearly had to govern through austerity in the early 80s, and depending on your point of view, but certainly electorally was very successful in doing so, aided by the Falklands War. But I don't think that was the only factor going in behind her big victory in 83 and 87. The others who've and Cameron, who when he came to power, was in 2010, again was having to govern through that in coalition with the Lib Dems. I actually thought the coalition government, the alliance government, was one of the better governments in my lifetime. I thought the Lib Dems did bring a stability into the picture, which allowed that government to address the problems of the economy and overspending. And we should remember that, of course, that Cameron won an overall majority in 2015, albeit very narrowly. But it wasn't his handling of the economy that brought him down. Of course, it was the Brexit vote and what happened afterwards that drove him out of office. So there have been examples of prime ministers who I think have been, what one might, you know, to varying degrees, say were successful in their management of an economy in difficulties and the need for austerity.
Mm. I wonder if we're almost coming to in terms of the end of this 14 years, whether we're coming to the end of a cycle, a rather epic cycle of political culture in this country, and whether things will be done differently, and whether Starmer sort of will be motivated or feels the need to initiate that process. He talks about it, but I wonder how damaged the political culture is, and therefore how functional or dysfunctional it will be going forward, where we still have the likes of, for example, the appointment of the Baroness Mohn of the House of Lords, controversially, Cameron and Greensill, and numerous other examples of unfortunateness, shall we say, is however you might put it. And equally, others on the Labour side.
It's generally the case, or has been generally the case historically, that it's the Tory politicians who are brought down by the sex scandals, and the Labour politicians who were brought down by the financial scandals. And there's actually been a lot of financial, you know, scandals associated with, particularly since the Boris Johnson premiership, where it really did feel like a lot of people were taking advantage of their positions in a way that it's difficult to imagine Theresa May doing, and certainly impossible to imagine someone like Gordon Brown doing. People who, whether you liked or disliked their policies, but one felt that they were genuine, honest politicians who had the good of the country right at the top of their agendas. So it's not going to be easy to drain that swamp. It's not as if this is the first time that people have been fed up with their politicians and distrusted them. Around the time of the Great Reform Act of 1832, which widened the franchise to considerably more men at the time, not working men, but a wider electorate. And there was great concern in the House of Commons, the moving the widening the franchise to some of these people. It would just lead to traffickers in office and politicians that you wouldn't be able to trust
The
because
great
they
old
were
wash, as it were, yeah.
desperate to be re-elected. So, yeah, these concerns are not new by any means. I'm not sure there ever has been a time where we've been completely and absolutely in awe of our politicians. You only have to watch Beyond the Fringe, and it's Peter Cook's masterful satire on Harold Macmillan to recognise these criticisms were around well over half a century ago. But I do think it's been worse. I think some of the behaviour of the, particularly it has to be said, of the present administration or the Conservative administration, has really been pretty shocking through.
Yeah, sort of an end of term sort of jinx and so forth. Graham, good afternoon. How are you? Are you with us? I think he's just getting all his audio together there. I wonder if we could now, Mal, turn to one of the issues that Starmer sought to address that's actually been highlighted by a protest this week outside the boardroom of a company called Deliveroo, which has holdings globally. I think in China and America, it's globally active, and there'd be parallel protests there. We're held in a... Sorry, I think you lost me there, Mal.
Yeah, just for a second. I was saying, I think it's unfortunate that the Labour Party, I think, hasn't been quite so robust over the potential, you know, allegations against Angela Rayner. I've no idea if they're true or not. I very much hope they're not, because she does seem to me a very interesting politician. But the kind of what's been coming out suggests that the tribalism's still there, and the Labour in power would seek to cover up and defend the wrongdoings of its own MPs. So maybe not to the same extent the Conservatives have done, but certainly to a considerable extent. And I hope that's not the case. I hope they will be more robust about standards in public life, because there have been quite a bit of erosion, I think, in the trust of Parliament recently.
Yes, it's a. I suppose you could call this a case for public morality and the link to corporate best practice that is evinced or not evinced by the opportunities or disadvantages of the gig economy. Deliveroo had a UK board meeting this week, and quite a number of its drivers turned out to protest, talking about the lack of rights and the what they would perceive as the shabby treatment of their employees, summary dismissal on no particular grounds. And I'm also thinking of Ken Loach's penultimate film based on the testimony of Amazon drivers called Sorry We Missed You, which seems to be an exercise in cruelty in the employment sphere, redolent of sort of pre-Victorian times. Anyway, be that as it may, I'm not suggesting a deliberate corollary between the two, but do you think the gig economy is something that needs to sort of be majorly reformed, or will it remain an aspect of our culture as a field of opportunity in entering the employment market? And does the situation of people, particularly with regard to a de-inquiry into people by the people's treatment by the DWP that's been started this week at sort of a paralegal level, indicate where the prospects for people in sort of austerity 2.0 might be propitious or otherwise?
I think it's a really difficult issue, and the Labour has said that they will certainly seriously reform zero-hour contracts. But on the other hand, it is clear that they have advantages. Firstly, there are quite a few people who are, you know, don't want to work too hard, but don't mind picking up a bit of pin money here and there. They're usually in a household where the main earner has a very significant salary. And so this is kind of just pin money for the odd extras that the other partner is looking for. I'm very happy to do a bit of work when it comes along and then not work at other times, rather than being tied to a contract where they'd have to, in effect, be working at the same time every week for the same number of hours. And secondly, there is a much greater degree of flexibility, which makes employing people more attractive, which in itself is a good thing. But against that, it's quite clear that the scope for exploitation of people with very little market power, only their own labour, in an area where there's quite a lot of potential people to take over, some relatively low-skilled jobs, for example. The great long fight of the fight of most of the 19th century and continuing for workers' rights to move towards a recognition that the role of the worker was in society went much beyond simply their economic output, but had to reflect and serve their interests as people, very often people with families. And like I said, to that point of view, I think some very serious look at how the 0 hours contracts are working in practice, and if there are ways of curbing the abuses while at the same time not overly interfering with the flexibility that it can bring both for employer and employee. I think looking at that seriously might be a good idea. It's one of those things where if you get too ideological in favour of it or against it, you're probably not going to get to the best overall outcome for the people who are affected.
I guess there are areas of the country, areas of continued economic challenge. I suppose I'm talking more or less about the north of England, where for a time at least, the gig economy was one of the very few opportunities to open to people. Hence the Loach film, and the people running health risks and the safety of children being put at risk by the working practices of a contractor employed by Amazon, to be specific about it. But it's really how interventionist you can now be in the modern world to build back opportunities that are actually about flexibility, yes, but also prospects and
Yeah,
aspirations.
my general philosophy on all this is that, the business of business is business, and companies, when left to their own devices, broadly speaking, are better at creating jobs and maintaining jobs than if they face a massive raft of regulation, which makes their job difficult. So this
And
is one of the
that's the
problems with.
default tendency, is that rather than corporate social responsibility, whatever that might be.
Yeah, I mean, you can combine those two. You can have companies that act well in the interests of their shareholders and of their employees. You think of the great, the Cadburys and the great philanthropic industrialists of the second half of the 19th century. Bourneville being created by the Cadbury family for their workers as a superb place to live. And also, I suspect, recognizing that a happy workforce was likely to be more productive as well.
That's the
People
thing.
felt that they were being treated fairly. Then, the old trade union call for a fair day's pay for a fair day's work was two ways. They wanted a fair day's pay, but they were prepared to offer a fair day's work to get it. And the more you, I suspect, just from a sheer, human point of view, mistreating workers is not the best way to get good output out of them, I'd have thought generally. But however that side of the argument goes, the workers' rights are extremely important, and it's been a massive, step forward for which the trade union's taken an enormous amount of credit over the last 200 years, that we have moved from the world of the early industrial revolution, described in, say, Hard Times, Dickens's novel Hard Times, and other contemporary reports of the time, where the lot of the new urban working class was pretty horrendous in many ways, to where we've got to today, where generally speaking, most people do live lives of comfort that could only have been imagined of in the Victorian era.
It's very important to take the long view on this, isn't it? And it's not all that far back in time. I suppose people felt that the gig economy was an attempt to erode some of those rights by default. I mean, I can see a different point of view, the one that you're embodying, in that it's a pragmatic way for some companies to operate. And but I'm also wondering if there is room, and whether it would be useful or indeed viable to encourage in a style of administration, should it come to pass, for companies to act in that sort of modified way, to be a little bit more involved in the way in which their surrounding communities are shaped, or indeed whether that's practical with the way that a modern workforce has to be managed.
The In the days when workers' rights were really beginning to develop, again, the second half of the 19th century and on into the 20th century, it was a combination of a number of very enlightened owners, company owners, and the whip hand of government through legislation, making sure that those that weren't as enlightened were forced into maintaining at least a minimum standard of duty of care towards their workers. And again, it works best when companies have as their genuine point of their ethos that they regard their workers as family almost, and will not, of course, jeopardize the financial future of the company. Company still has to make profits, it still has to pay its shareholders, and it still has to pay senior management if they're good at their job to stay in place. But if that can be done while alongside, celebrating and rewarding a loyal workforce, then those sorts of practices, there are many, many companies that give their workers an experience way above the national minimum requirements. And I say in part because they're that sort of people, I suspect, but in part because they see that as a way of getting much more commitments and therefore much more productivity out of their workforce themselves.
It's very interesting to hear that of the week that Paula Venables was testifying against the, or within, to the tribunal, I should say, that's looking into the Horizon software scandal. She has been sort of casually mentioning her candidature for a priesthood, if I remember rightly. She's completed her training, but doesn't seem to have cut much ice with the prosecuting barrister. What do you make of the future of that style of management, and indeed the future of the post office? Would it need to, for example, rebrand as that sort of socially responsible institution in order to have a future?
Well, it's interesting that this week we've got the announcements on the blood scandal, the contaminated
And it's
blood
dark
from
indeed in the
America
firing line for that.
that caused such 30,000 people who were whose li either lost their lives or were severely affected by particularly HIV and hepatitis C, where the story that has emerged is clearly one of the most dreadful cover-up by the health service and the government. And the post office, where the details obviously are very different, but the theme is still the same. But and this is one of the things that always worries me about the idea of we've just got to renationalize these industries and that will put them right. Thames Water and the rail companies and the energy companies will suddenly start working completely in the public good. But of course, the National Health Service is a national monopoly, and the blood scandal is only the latest of a whole string of most dreadful behaviours within the health service. You can go back to Harold Shipman, certainly within the aegis of the health service, the Alder Hey Children's Hospital, the Burns unit in Bristol. There's a whole string of these cases where the National Health Service behaved extremely badly, then covered it up, then absolutely persecuted any whistleblowers who dare to say what's going on. And the post office, another national monopoly, behaving in very much the same way. I mean, state ownership is by no means a guarantee that the companies or the individuals within those companies are going to behave well.
It had been
Indeed, you could have.
privatised, hadn't it, by George Osborne at the point when this occurred, or am I wrong?
Sorry, say again.
So it had been privatised by George Osborne at the point where this took place, hadn't it? But I may be wrong
No,
there.
that was
It
it was
dates
Royal
back
Mail.
before that. Right, thank you.
It was Royal Mail that was privatised, not
Yes,
the post
I
office.
beg your pardon. Thank you for correcting me.
Yeah, I mean Royal Mail is a private operator, but
Yes.
not as far as I know. But it's not in a position to have. I must say that there's no sign that there's been any wrongdoing on the Royal Mail. But in any case, it wasn't in a, the real thing with the post office was it had all these franchised sub postmasters
Yes.
who were independent operatives, but dependent on the post office for their livelihoods, really, who were so dreadfully, dreadfully let down. And that was within a state-owned monopoly. So you cannot, it's a very dangerous point of view to say that state-owned monopolies will automatically be oriented towards the public good as the number one concern. The evidence suggests that that just doesn't seem to be the case, and that state-owned monopolies are just as capable of misbehavior as are commercial companies in the competitive marketplace. And we've got to be very careful, I think, with a lot of these things of falling into that trap of thinking that the simple act of nationalizing or renationalizing these companies and utilities will simply dissolve the whole issue. That's not what evidence suggests.
It's a problem of corporate culture, whatever the aegis is. Yeah.
Well, they haven't got round to.
Oh, hi, Graham.
Hi. I have been here for a bit.
I'm sorry, I couldn't see you on the screen. I do apologise. Thank you for chiming in.
They haven't got round to examining the underlying cause, really, which is the attitude towards machine decisions and the human decisions. Fujitsu hasn't really come up much.
Yeah, this is your point about Horizon, the software, isn't it, and the glitches and that.
Yeah,
etc.
And the plaintiffs don't seem to have mentioned it, or the defendants. So it's interesting in terms of AI as well, but. The word of the machine is unquestionable, and that's at the root of the whole case, surely.
It's a rounder thing, and it's not quite the same thing, but it's on corporate culture generally. My late father was a manual engineering draftsman. He designed rolling mills to make steel. But I remember one of the managers coming up and saying that a new colleague of his, who he was mentoring, very talented chap, had a degree, so he should be able to work more quickly. Very strange argument, because the complexity of the problems they were solving on the fly, which is now done by software, I gather, to which these statistics were aggregated and added, it's very, very variable.
Yeah, of course, the machine can do everything so much quicker than any human,
provided it's of a fairly uniform nature. But this is not that kind of a problem, is it?
No, but the mitigation of believing the machine, I would have thought, could have been put in as a defense argument.
Yeah.
Because they've just blindly followed the machine. They used that machine argument. The original prosecutors said, well, the machine can't be wrong. The machine says it. So you've stolen. You're a thief.
But this is a problem about measuring human integrity, isn't it? As well as probability, as well as measuring the statistics.
As you can say, Graham clearly raising an important point there, but it does go further than that, though, because there was a point where the post office was simply lying to, it seems, when it was saying, and the most obvious one, whenever anyone rang in saying, nobody else has raised this issue with us, when there were literally thousands of people who'd made these sorts of complaints to the post office. So trying to isolate individuals like that, that were, that it's difficult to explain that simply in terms of an over,
overreliance of technology.
Of the technology. There's an extra angle to it there, where you start twisting what you're saying to cover things up, where at that point you must be, the very fact that you feel that you have to lie about that means that you're obviously not confident in what's going on. If you're entirely confident the machinery is right, then you'd be quite comfortable telling people, yeah, we've heard a few of these things, we don't think it's right.
I think Greg is saying that it's the belief that it cannot be wrong, because then the sky will fall down, which seems to be where Bernard was coming from.
I agree, Malcolm, that it does go further as to inquiring as to whether they were lying. If they knew that the machine was wrong, which apparently they did, then of course they're lying. If they didn't know the machine was lying, they had no reason to believe, then they were taking that as indisputable, that the machine couldn't make a mistake. But apparently they did know that the machine was making a mistake.
And the culture didn't allow them to admit it somehow.
Well, they were using the belief in the machine as the excuse. That's how they continue their prosecutions against all the evidence of the humans. So in other words, they say, well, you're just a human. Obviously, if the machine says that, then you can't have done anything otherwise, right?
That's the logical conclusion, isn't it? Suddenly you sound very much like Arthur C. Clarke there, Graham. I see exactly what you mean. Yes.
Well, it's a mistake about the accuracy of the machine as well. That's the point. It's the point about AI as well, of course.
Yeah.
And, you know, which you can immediately translate into the AI war taking place in Gaza.
So
it's machines that are making decisions to kill.
Sure.
Okay. Well, they can be wrong, you know, and they have been wrong. And but the Israelis seem to be saying, well, it's the machine who made it, so it can't be wrong, you know.
If you're proud of your industrial achievements, and that's the axial to the way in which you're prosecuting what you're doing in modern life, it's that. I think I can see a corollary there. I'm not sure if you'd agree with that, Mal. But let me ask you both what the legacy of this scandal may be in terms of how companies operate. And presumably, new oversights need to be in place with regard to the use of software, don't they? Or will that need to be the case?
Well, I think it entered into law that you have to question the machine as well as the human.
Right. Interesting
you
notion.
You can't simply assume that the machine is right.
Mm.
And is honest.
Nature, yeah.
You can't assume the machine is honest.
Yeah.
The shape and the feel of these latest scandals, they just feel the same as Hillsborough. When for years the Liverpool fans were absolutely wrongly and shockingly blamed for the failures of the institutions, that the police in particular, that led to the tragedy at Hillsborough all those years ago. It feels the same as Grenfell Tower, where all of these themes going on about authorities cutting corners and sometimes quite patiently breaking the law to cut those corners, and then wholeheartedly covering them up when the tragedy does occur, and finding every way possible to do that. And that's kind of independent. The same technological arguments were just not in play when Hillsborough took place, and yet the institutional response looks very, very similar in all of these cases, which does suggest that yes, absolutely, undoubtedly, the informational angle and the mechanizing of so many things. The further thing was the two Boeing
737s
who crashed, where the second one crashed for exactly the same reason as the first one. But in the first case, Boeing had pulled out all the stops to have it said that it was pilot error and that it was nothing to do with the machinery. So there clearly is a new point about bowing down too far in front of machinery. But the institutional response is depressingly similar to those we were seeing before the age where artificial intelligence was so important now. And again, was very often, the police cover-up. That's another, localized, but still a monopoly, a state-run monopoly, the police, as it has to be. With Grenfell, it was the local authority and a monopoly housing association that was looking after Grenfell.
Grenfell is entirely human. Yeah, and there's no machine excuse in Grenfell.
Yeah, and so it is recognizing that we mustn't lose sight of the fact that right at the heart of all of these things, there are basically institutions which have their own agenda, in which protection of the public is not the top priority, and actually may not be a very high priority at all. And in that sense, state-owned monopolies or large private conglomerates in competition with each other, if you actually look at their behaviour, doesn't always look all that different.
So it's a huge question, I suppose, but what could be done to put this right? I mean, how can we unite these recent dystopian experiences, and not so recent in the case of the NHS blood scale, as you mentioned earlier on, Val, to point the way to a better future?
Well, at the heart of the answer is regulation. It is serious regulation. One of the awful things about Grenfell is that it was clearly, in the context of the obsession of Eric Pickles as the relevant minister and the government of the day on deregulating, where you could not introduce a new regulation unless you initially it was unless you rescinded an existing one.
This was
Danny
scandalism,
McKenzie,
wasn't it? Yeah, but yeah.
You couldn't introduce a new one unless you rescinded three existing regulations. And so you've got the most, desperate need for regulation, which Grenfell has demonstrated. But the civil servants who were arguing for that then kind of off their own bat had to dash around finding regulations that they could do without. And the amount of wasted effort on that, rather than just recognizing, certainly, over-regulation can be, in some cases, as damaging as under-regulation. It needs, regulation as an aim is not something that I've ever thought was a good thing. But when regulation is so clearly unfit for purpose, then you should be able quite quickly and quite nimbly to put it right, rather than being in the context of having to find alternative things to knock off the statute book before you're allowed to look at solving a problem that may just have arisen.
What's the broad answer in law, do you think, Graham? Mal speaks of regulation there, which I suppose didn't say if you take the press code as a voluntary thing, but this presumably needs to be rather more than that.
Well, I think it's bad law, distinguishing bad law, and to make a law that you have to get rid of a regulation before you can introduce another one, is clearly very bad law, because it doesn't address the purpose of which the law is applied. If there's a requirement for a particular law, say to stop people dying by fire, being burned to death, then to say that you can't introduce that law until you get find another one you can. Is a dereliction of duty, more or less. I mean,
But it
it's
was an
clearly
ideological
bad.
tenet of a government.
It's illogical, yeah, totally illogical. So I mean, and it's unconstitutional. I mean,
I'm so
that's
glad to hear that phrase again. It's been a while.
The way that this Brexit government is applying the Constitution is just simply wrong. I mean, they don't understand the law, and they don't understand government either. So they're just really, really bad at governance.
So it's bad, but how? What good law, as it were, as in the Good Law Project et al., could be drafted in order to engineer a process by which regulation is required or implied as a necessity?
Well, it's in constant, every judgment in a court of law, adapts the system to make good law, to continue good law, as against bad law. That's what it's all about. That's what all the arguments are put up for.
So it's a question of evolution through findings, and that therefore somebody will pick this up and run with it.
Yeah, and the
That's a
idea
contract.
that a government minister could come in and make an arbitrary introduction of a law or an arbitrary dismissal of a law, like Gove tried to do with the planning law, is against the Constitution. I mean, it's just fundamentally bad practice.
So it's but what you're arguing for is a restitution of the rule of law and the respect for the law as underpinning the way in which legislation is drafted and
Exactly.
enacted and interpreted.
It's all in the process. If you want to do something, this is how you have to do it.
Yeah.
It's not arbitrary. It's not a choice of whether you apply the law or not. The law must be applied. I mean, that's the point of having the law, is to tell you how to do things and how they must be done and how you cannot, in contrast, how the all of the, I mean, the saying in law is anything the law doesn't say that you can't do, then you can do it. If the law says you cannot do this, or if you do this, you must do it this way, then you can't do it another way. It's
Indeed, and there will be a rationale which will be argued through, presumably.
of course, it's the politicians who want to take more power for themselves. They object to this. They said, we don't want to be bound by the law that's already established over years, hundreds of years. we want to change it to our benefit, you know, personal government benefit. And the system just falls apart if you do that.
Berardini has, but not quite, I suppose, because the Constitution, you would say, it's the Constitution. In conclusion, for now, Graham, I'd like to give you an opportunity.
It's a very long way from falling apart. It's only just begun to be accepted that someone like Johnson or Liz Truss can do the things they did, crazy things that are just against the law.
Okay. Duly noted.
And you have to say, I have to add, of course, Brexit was the first time it occurred by machine. And it's machine intelligence that got Brexit. Now, the fact that the government didn't recognise how it had been achieved and purposely exploited machines in getting their own way against the public interest, against the national interest. You know, the government are not allowed to act against the country's interest. That's the fundamental point of the Constitution. Act against the country's interest.
Yeah. Which implies a kind of techno-fetishism. I wonder if we can get any conclusion that maybe...
it's exploitation. It's not a fetish. It's an exploitation, pure and simple.
Yes. Let's park that for a moment. It might sort of come back in a way, I suppose, if you consider the consultation of a range of 8 to 16-year-olds of the Coventry area where telecom business EE has a lot of corporate interest. They've gone into junior secondary schools and they've asked kids to think about the cities of the future. And they seem to have come up with some awareness of the importance of things like solar panels and alternative energy. One wonders when it's a good time to introduce these topics and how you do it in such a way that doesn't scare the bejesus out of them in terms of our climate prospects. I'm wondering if you've had a go at this, Mal, in your various school visits as a physicist, or did a few years ago.
As with many things, you try and make the talk relevant to the whichever age you're talking to, and my thing always try and make it as concrete as possible, so bring it as much into the everyday lives rather than being too theoretical. You can be theoretical with sixth formers when they've got to what Piaget used to call formal operations, but when they can start sort of reasoning abstractly. But for younger children, abstract reasoning is not very usual. It's more a matter of reasoning through the concrete things that are around them and that they can directly envisage. I think it's the other thing is to, and it is difficult, is to get over a sense that there are some areas where there's still enormous uncertainty and some areas where there's relatively little uncertainty. And trying to come up with a set of policies for today that will respond to all of these possible futures, it's the heart, of course, of scenario planning, is that in scenarios, you're not coming up with predictions of the future. You're saying the future might turn out to be like this, 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 or this. What can we do today that means if it turns out that the first option will be okay, if it turns out in any of the others will be okay, it's not perfect for any of them because that will be going down the road of predicting the future. But it's giving us the flexibility to respond to an uncertain world as that world unfolds. I mean, there is very, very little scientific dispute about the basics of climate change, for example, that certain gases increase the opacity of the atmosphere to heat getting out and therefore move the equilibrium temperature of the globe upwards, of which carbon dioxide and methane are probably the two main ones, but there are various others that we've got to be careful about. But the wider social debate about, I mean, firstly, we don't really know the speed at which this is going to happen and is happening. We don't know the exact social costs and where those social costs will fall at various types of action. I mean, those are areas where there's still enormous debate and enormous uncertainty. And I think getting over to children the idea that I think there's too many things that are being taught as facts to children today. And this goes through the trans debate, it goes through all sorts of international issues, where actually there is far more both uncertainty and individual people's values involved, and needing to get over to what is an absolute key skill for any rising generation, but perhaps particularly for the rising generation at the moment, is the ability to think critically, is the ability to
Oh,
assimilate
amen and
information.
amen. Yes, totally.
Yeah, you get information from a lot of different sources coming at you, and how you, certainly as an individual, you have to make some sort of judgment about the things that you think are credible and the things that you think are you're being sold a pup on. But the ability to recognize that in many cases, people who are genuine in what they're saying are giving you quite different views on life, and none of those views should be taken as gospel. They all should be subject to criticism. And this is where I think the rise of certain, fundamental religious movements of all sorts in the States and in the Middle East and elsewhere is so damaging, because of course that sticks, that forces unarguable dogma on you. Anybody who dares to say, well, hang on a minute, is this really right? Becomes a heretic and therefore open to persecution.
Yeah,
Whereas, of
not
course, all the
unlike
way
in
through.
the sense the management of the post office, I suppose.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can get that in non-secular. So I'm absolutely not saying you only get that within religion, but there is something at the heart of most religions where there is a an unchallengeable truth. Indeed, that's where I think the word religion emerges and the concept of religion emerges. And we need to be able, I think a healthy society would be one which would encourage all of us to just be that bit skeptical, to look seriously at what we've been presented with, and to be prepared to change our minds when more information comes along. And I'm not sure that that's the way even that science is taught in schools. It's very often taught about scientific facts, and this is, science tells us the way the world is, and it doesn't. Science gives us information on which to make intelligent guesses about the future. It doesn't tell us what the future is going to be like, because nobody can do that. Nothing can do that. It just gives us a discipline whereby we can say, this is probably what we should be doing today in order to respond to the various futures that might emerge. And I don't think that skill is terribly highly prized at the moment.
And that's a debate, I suppose, about the philosophy of education, educating the young. What do you make of children as designers, Graham? Have you had occasion to interact with them? And do you think they can grasp some of the principles in the report that EE have generated, albeit it's corporately sponsored, called Children of the Future, notes that 44% has realised that solar panels were going to be important, 47.9, I beg your pardon, 48% mentioned cost, and 17% mentioned sort of the human factor and being able to get along in these environments. And there was one of the devices they come up with was a robot that would pick up litter, I mean, at least in the nascent form. Which possibly says a lot about their human motivation. But again, what do you make about children as designers, and is it good practice to get them involved in this sort of a way?
Yeah, well, designers have to know how reality behaves. So they accept, for example, that if you drop an object, it falls to the ground under gravity. Now, as Malcolm says, scientifically, that's been proved beyond reasonable doubt, certainly. But it's also certain enough to be able to reject any suggestion that it's not going to fall to the ground. And all design is based on the certainty of nature behaving in the same way under the laws of the physics. So when you start trying to establish a fact, and they say all children are scientists because they carry
It's a
out
wonderful
experiments.
composition.
Yeah, they carry out experiments. They're always experimenting to see how
So
things
their play
actually
is a
happen.
form of experimentation.
Yeah, and so they learn, that you fall over or that you hurt yourself or flames burn you. I mean, these are also learned facts as sort of confirmed by experiment. And so that's the way that facts are established. And the science of global warming is the science of Earth system dynamics. And that's a very advanced science. And it's proved as a fact that we are going extinct. We are on a direct path to extinction. Now, that is a fact. It's not an opinion. It's not an interpretation.
You have to present that to children in a way that won't scare them. I suppose that's the difficulty.
That's the political decision. And there's widespread political feeling that it's a bad thing to tell children the truth that we're going extinct because it will affect them. And it is affecting them. Apparently, you know, a region of 70% or so are anxious about the future because of global warming.
That's very important to know in this context, I think. Yes. Yeah.
Well, and the fact that the fact of extinction is being suppressed, or not, the children not being informed of it, or anybody else for that matter, is only adds to the anxiety. You know, you'd have to get behavioral scientists and psychologists and analysts to come in to see what effect is being done, which, of course, those sciences are nowhere near the advance of Earth system dynamics. So you can't, and that's where the confusion comes in, is people's interpretation. And there's a widespread misinterpretation of relativity. A lot of people think it means that everything is relative, therefore your opinion is as good as anyone else's.
They tweak it to be postmodernism, as it were. Yeah.
And that's the basis of creationism in the States.
Yes.
So you want to go backwards. And that's the state of the general state of the political sphere at the moment, is that anybody's getting a say, and anybody can have an opinion, and you end up with people like Trump.
Is it therefore implicitly politically dangerous to have children not only being scientists at a young age and not diverted by the various other things that might detain them, and that then carrying that forward and retaining that childlike sense of inquiry, as I suppose some people might argue the great scientists did, the Einsteins, Al, the real pioneers, to make changes that will challenge the path that we're currently on. Because what if you go to entertain that politically, within a political economy, you have to be prepared to be shown to be actively on the wrong track.
Well, that's the assessment of the value of scientific advance. And as Malcolm says, it's always open to new discovery and disproving of certain facts. But there has to be some sort of ratcheting mechanism that people can't arbitrarily say, oh, well, that hasn't been proven, or I don't think that's correct. And I've decided that I'll have a different theory, and your theory is no better than mine.
I suppose this is really a psychological argument, Mal. That as a scientist, do you think that childlike sense of inquiry can be maintained the way that Einstein maintained it? And I'm making a value judgment there that may be entirely wrong about the man's character, and that indeed it is a necessary thing into adult inquiry, and that the partial nature of the adult world and so forth.
I think it can. I think it's the difficulties with a lot of these things now is that sometimes the statements of what is proven and unarguable go beyond what the science can actually withstand at a particular moment, and then you get examples of where it goes the other way. I've got the MMR scandal in mind, where apparently honourable doctor was telling people, if you vaccinate your children, you'll there's a danger that they'll get autism because of that, completely without foundation. And just this week, there was another warning about measles in the UK, where a system that was was put forward as being true at the time, and a lot of investigative journals like Private Eye swallowed it and promoted it. Now, the benefit of hindsight, we can say that was dreadful science. It was dreadful science. It was completely dishonest. It turned out that Andrew Wakefield, the that the doctor in question was on a nice big fat retainer from the families who would receive a large amount of compensation if they if the charge was proved. But the difficulty is, you know, epistemologically, you can't always tell what the good science is and the bad science is at the actual time. There's a lot of very widely accepted scientific theories which have turned out not to be the case subsequently, but didn't look like bad science at the time. And in a sense, they're only bad science because they turned out not to fit reality because something else was discovered later that they didn't know about.
Subsequent scientists would welcome, you know, there's a difference. They just disproved me and they can't pop us in a way. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a difference between bad science and science that is proved incorrect. I mean, Newton was wrong. Newtonian mechanics are, you know, pretty much, well, they're very, very different from what we now think in terms of the quantum theories. But Newton's laws were, you know, brilliantly, you know, deduced from observation at the time. Yeah. And for most everyday situations are still perfectly adequate to design the world. They just don't happen to be the basis that they assumed, which basically the very, very small world is just like the very big world, only smaller. Whereas we now believe the very world, very, very small world is unimaginably weird. And things can exist in the same place at the two places at the same time, and can tunnel through infinite barriers, and all these things, you know, and the thing can be a wave and a particle at the same time. All these things, which are just so unimaginably weird that we can't conceive them, and yet quantum mechanics tells us that they're right. Now that doesn't mean that Newton was either a bad or a dishonest scientist. He was one of the most brilliant men in history, but as time goes by, we learn more about the world, and new theories come along that either displace previous theories or refine them to new circumstances. So it's kind of all very well saying we should only listen to good science and not to bad science, but we don't always know at the time which is the good science and which is the bad science.
Which I suppose is where... Go ahead.
You know, if you get a consensus of scientists that only a tiny minority disagree with, then it's obviously wise to follow the consensus of science.
But you've just described the beginning of the quantum revolution at the beginning of the 20th century. Even Einstein himself refused to believe the consequences of what his science was telling him. And in his gravitational constant, or in his equations about the expansion of the universe, he just couldn't believe what his science was pointing towards, which was a moment of creation, a Big Bang. And so he introduced a constant into his equations completely randomly, just because he couldn't believe the quantity, you know, the whole of, you know, it's actually the other way around. Most scientific developments and big leaps forward in science start with a small number of people, whether it's Galileo being prosecuted by the Catholic Church or whoever it is. They begin with a very small group of people who are saying, hey, hang on. We're seeing some anomalies here. And the rest of the scientific community saying, no, this is nonsense. We understand this. We've known this for many years. What you're saying is nonsense. And it can take quite a long time for the new thinking to get through, even when it's based on, you know, some replicable, very good replicable experiments as the beginning of the quantum revolution was. The beginning the quantum revolution is exactly an example of where the vast majority of the scientific community held one view and a few researchers held an opposite view, which was completely poo-pooed and rejected for quite some time before quite rapidly it became the mainstream. And the great early figures of quantum mechanics, having been reviled, suddenly became the new scientific heroes.
Yeah, but they didn't say they didn't replace Newton. Everyone continued with Newton, and Newton's incorporated into quantum mechanics. So it's not a question
because quantum mechanics, you know, Newton's laws are what happens if you start to build up a quantum world, and the probabilities ultimately take you to Newtonian mechanics, which therefore remain very, very useful. But there were all sorts of things. Yeah, there was a very interesting In Our Time program on Nikolai Tesla a couple of weeks ago.
Nice.
the great American rival to Edison. And one of the big disputes of the age was Edison, who was wedded to direct current, and Tesla, who was much more interested in alternating current. And of course, history has shown us how Tesla won. But the whole world, because it was so difficult to make a motor that ran on alternating current, the Tesla was very much an outcast and thought to be something of a nutter for quite a long time before it was before he could begin to demonstrate actually what I'm saying has got a lot to it. And he won the battle of the current. You know, the world now runs on alternating current, not on direct current. And even the great Edison was proven to be wrong on that occasion. So there's lots and lots of these examples where the minority view is reviled and put in a box around science. And that's what happened at the beginning of quantum revolution. Not that they said this is going to displace Newton, so it must be wrong, because it was never going to do that. But the actual fundamentals of wave-particle duality, of so much being quantized, and particularly right at the heart of it, the idea that, light is quantized. Those were roundly rejected by the scientific community of the time for quite some decades before they just became irresistible, because more and more scientific evidence was pointing to their veracity.
So gentlemen,
are you saying, Malcolm, that you're going to rely on some new theory about extinction to arrive and not rely on a system, whole Earth system dynamics?
Where there is, I mean, this is where there are too many uncertainties. What you are saying is now completely counter about extinction. It's completely counter to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, for example, which is the international body which was set up to be stewards of the emerging debate about the climate and what we might be able to do about it. And the working group one on the science now has very much backed away from these doomsday scenarios. What is more emerging is this is going to be exceedingly serious, and we really should do something very major about it, because it will certainly lead in some areas of the world to very, very negative consequences. But it's not now. The basic science is not. It's down right at the edge of the sort of beyond the 90% or 95% likelihood of it actually being a species threatening. Now, you don't want to live in a world where there's a 10% chance of being wiped out if you can help it. That's certainly true. But the science is not pointing towards inevitable extinction, because already we have changed enough in the course of the last 20 years to get us off those scenarios that were beginning to point in that direction. You'd need to see a world that went back to burning coal massively, for example, to get to anything like the carbon emissions that were assumed in some of those early, very pessimistic assumptions. And ultimately, it doesn't do any good exaggerating those statements, because that of itself will prompt a dissenting movement. And we are seeing very much in many developing countries now people turning their back on net zero. The new Dutch government has done so in the course of the last week. The very little doubt that an incoming Trump administration would do so. And even within British politics, there seems, the Labour Party has backed off its original £26 billion pledge towards the green economy. So even the liberal left, for whom climate is supposed to be right at the heart of what they're doing, are just backing down a bit from some of their earlier statements. And that's closely connected to people starting to feel that there's a group of people who have a vested interest in exaggerating these things because they'll make money out of it. And that's certainly true. But seeing that as being a reason to distrust the areas where I think the science is much sounder. And you have to bring people along with you ultimately. This is where Extinction Rebellion have gone wrong and Just Stop Oil have gone wrong, is by antagonizing the people they need to bring along. I sometimes wonder whether they're actually funded by the oil industry, because the oil industry is the area which has had the greatest benefit out of Just Stop Oil annoying people so much.
And there's some evidence that Rockefeller's daughter had an interest, at least in the beginnings of Just Stop Oil, if I remember rightly. Graham?
Malcolm, would you say that James Hansen, the ex-head of NASA, who's just published a paper in an Oxford journal, that saying that the calculations for the arrival of the point of no return has been that we have too much time, we have a lot more time, and is in fact we have far less time before the point of no return arrives. You'd say
that's me. You know, I'm all in favour of those who hold a minority view on the extinction side of climate change, arguing that case, because they may turn to be right, that's where science works, is where dissenters to the mainstream view at the moment, which is that this is serious but not extinction threatening. Right. Those who have reasons for arguing that actually it is a threat to extinction should, of course, be making that case and should be very seriously listened to, because the stakes are so high. Even if there's only a 10% chance of extinction, I don't want to live in a world where there's a 10% chance of extinction if we can do anything about it. I'm absolutely in favour. And Hansen was one of the first who really, the environmental movement, who really argued very, very powerfully for massive expansion of nuclear power, for particularly, I've always exactly agreed with that, largely because it has a very positive effect on carbon emissions. So don't get me wrong, I am not a climate skeptic. I think we should be doing far more than we are doing. Heading towards a net zero ultimately has to be a goal we aim towards. It's the wider point they're making, that if you don't bring the people along with you, and if you are seen that you might be exaggerating things, then that kind of gives people an excuse to move towards a much more psychologically comfortable position, which is actually it's probably all going to be all right. We're worrying about nothing, because it's a massive psychological toll on the individual to move into a world where they're thinking extinction might be a possibility.
Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. I'm sorry we have to end it there. Have a great weekend.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Cheers.
Bye.